vice president here yesterday. Coach Roy stepping down. They will
So I think it's actually part of, you know, what we'll be talking about with the proper role of bias, because it affects it. And one of the things that I see is it's, you know, we start off in 2010 and 11 and 12 as this really got going with bias, I think, started really coming through with CFPB. And at first, it was really seen as just a gatekeeper and keep the wolf outside the door, right? Like, that's what you had to do with compliance. And I think over time, it's evolving, and I think you're going to see continue to evolve and how you can best utilize it within your organization. I don't want to cover anything any other speaker has covered, but I thought it kind of potentially be interesting to you guys to understand what's going on and how that's going to change CFPB, and that might be relevant to this whole discussion. Have you guys already talked a lot about the appointments and how it's going to affect things? Has somebody already covered that for everybody or not? Or do you want a different perspective? All right.
Yes.
Okay, if you get bored, just tell me to move on. Okay. By the way, any of the presentations I ever do, this is a discussion, not a presentation, so feel free to interrupt. You don't have to wait for them to ask questions. So, you know, essentially, here's where it is. There are kind of two, right now, Cordia's going to step down. I assume that the person who's now his acting assistant will become his assistant. Okay? Now, under the presidential power, it's something called the vacancy format. He has the right to appoint, either allow that person to continue to be the assistant or take over and be the director for 210 days, or he has the power to appoint somebody who is of equal or greater level, that is somebody who has been confirmed by the Senate, so forth and so on, to take over that role. Now, there's another portion of Dodd-Frank that may slightly conflict with it. I think because this specifically deals with appointments, when there's a change of control in an agency, this one probably takes precedence. And so what that means is that if he wants to, Trump can do one of two things. Either allow the current assistant to take over, well, acting assistant will be the assistant, to maintain for 210 days. I think that one is slim to none and slim left out, okay, because that's Cordray's hand-picked successor, right? Okay, so that's option A. Option B is probably Steve Mnuchin, who, obviously, as we know, Trump already picked to lead, and he would probably, I think, be appointed to take over. But here's the thing, it's only for 210 days, okay? Now, that means he's got to get somebody through the Senate and the confirmation process at some point in time after that, because he can't continue forever and ever, right? So, who's going to be the next head of the CFPB? I don't know, names have to be thrown out there. One thing I can tell you is that it's given the makeup that it currently looks like with Congress, and you've seen, I mean, we've seen how much has been accomplished in the last year, right? Like, how many things have passed? I'm being completely facetious. But look, there's not going to be some, Jeb Pensarling's favorite person is not going to be confirmed, right? I mean, it's going to be somebody, I think, that's going to have to get both sides on this. Either that, or there'll have to be some consistent reappointments. There are situations like that where they could be reappointed and reappointed for some period of time until, obviously, somebody can get something through Congress. But the idea of 5 more years of a switch going to somebody who is completely the opposite of Cordray, I think that is not very realistic. At best, you could have some period of time, even maybe, through till, you know, another election, another presidential cycle, unless Trump wins again. I mean, and again, not making any commentaries. Polls don't really seem to support that, although they didn't last time either. But whatever happens, right? I mean, the idea of getting somebody in for a long period of time is going to have a very, very different view, I think, is unlikely. So it's either going to be somebody who's going to be a little more middle of the road, which I think we'd all probably still clap to, right? But somebody who's going to be completely the opposite long term, probably not happening. And I think that's important to kind of understand the proper role of compliance, because the other thing you got to remember is, you know, states aren't going away. And I will tell you, I've already seen CFPB pull back in the last couple of months. So you probably haven't heard of any major kind of groundbreaking that they did in what? Texas stories or Houston stuff in the last 3 years. How often did you hear a they did what when talking about the CFPB in cases? They just come up with, yeah, I know it's $6 million, it's $190 million now. Too bad. Right? They did that all the time. That stopped. smart. So they realized what they had to do, and so they could pick on good targets for that. And if you think of who they got after, places like Navient, right? You know, for anybody who's ever steal a loan, called Navient. Not a ton of synergy, right? No offense to that company, but I'm just saying, those are good targets for them. They're juicy, they're easy, right? They've been concentrating on that. So the typical mortgage bank, community lender, who's tried to do things right, really hasn't had that many problems with the CFPB in the last couple months. And some of this enforcement by regulation by enforcement, we've seen drop down. But what I have seen is a huge pickup on states and HUD and FHA. They are now getting very active. So it's almost like one saw the other stepping back, and they said, "We got it. We're going to take over." Backup quarterback is probably a rough subject here in Indianapolis these days. I'm not a Cowboys fan. I've got my own problems, but it's sort of like what you've seen go on. So with that, any other questions? Kind of what's going on there? That was actually really funny. I have to laugh myself. I literally said 2 years ago in a speech that I thought that Corduroy was going to stay for the rest of his term. It was the next day. At least I said I didn't know that. It was just like speculation, so I saved myself a little. But, all right, so let's talk about how the Rainbow Road products now and how it really can become more part of your organization and do better things. So right now, look, I mean, the problem with so compliance today, I love it when these things don't show up, but essentially what you're talking about now is a scenario where the role of compliance today is in many cases a gatekeeper. So what happens is the cycle, if you will. You have an issue on the sales team, and then sales goes to management, and then management and sales get together and come up with a solution. And then at some point somebody goes, yeah, we probably should go to past compliance. Maybe that happens. And then everything's ready to go, right? The flyers are printed. People have already started talking about it. They run into the compliance department.
All right, could you move your microphone up just a little bit?
Is that any better?
I don't
know. Yeah, it's just... How about that? So where were we? We were at sales and management had already figured it out, right? All right, so they've already figured that out, everybody's happy. And now they have to go to compliance, and they run this idea, this bright idea past compliance, and somebody says no, right? You can't do it. And then sort of all the air gets deflated, and everybody hates compliance, and essentially the cycle goes down from there. And some of the problems with that are, many times it goes straight past compliance to an actual problem, right? Because the person who's identifying the risk point isn't the person whose job is to identify the risk point. It's somebody else, right? So you ask the sales guy about the risks, bad idea, right? It is. And by the way, I say that with endearment to all the salespeople here, because I'm one of them too at times. So the other thing also is that I see a lot of times where people get on the phone with me like, oh, we can do this because, and they sort of rationalize why they think it's okay. And sometimes on a common sense analysis, you might think it's okay, we're not hurting anybody, that's true, but there are technical rules. Like, you could give a really good justification for going 70 miles an hour at 55. I've tried, but it's still 55 miles an hour, right? Like, that's still the problem. So you have to be aware of that when you can't do that. And a lot of these rules are counterintuitive, right? They don't make common sense. So these are all reasons why that first part, the identification issues, sometimes breaks down. Then you also have the problem where really, and this is a really problematic situation, it sets up compliance as the bad guy. And the reason why, I know some people are like, well, yeah, they are the bad guy. But sometimes they're not. And what I'm actually really going to talk about today is making them not the bad guy. Because what really occurs is when you have that, it sets up this scenario where you have people who want to go rogue, right? They don't want to bring things to compliance because that's the reputation where you're just going to cut me. You're just going to stop it. And I've got to do what I've got to do. So it becomes a chasing the cats, hurting the cats type of situation. And that's never ideal because the cats are doing what the cats do and someone can't always rip them all in. The other thing is also a lot of times I would argue an inaccuracy of information. So what gets to compliance is not really what's actually happening. It's the spin to what you want to have happen. I cannot tell you how many times I get on the phone with a client who says, listen, my branch manager and so-and-so wants to do XYZ. And so look, you know, I've heard a lot of things these days, and you know, you start hearing something and you hear the story and then you're like, okay, so this is really what you're doing, right? If I had a nickel for every time, I tell you 80% of the time this happens, people call me up and say, well, we're gonna be a non-producing branch, so you can pass on profitability, right? So I'm like, okay, well, what's your name? I get the guy's name. I'm talking to the branch manager while this is going on. I'm Googling his name. And I see literally first thing is Joe, hi, call me for your mortgage. We have the best loan rates in town. Like, is that you, Joe? Yeah, did you know you have a website? Well, I mean, I'm gonna take that down. The call tends to end fairly quickly after that, right? Because he hasn't been doing this for a year. So I'm just saying, I'm joking about a little bit of that. My point is, you've got to make sure that information is accurate. If they're seen as the other team, not your team, you're setting up a situation where then you can get problems through. So essentially, the better mousetrap that I'm talking about, and where I think compliance can be brought in, is really bringing them in at the beginning. So what I'm talking about is, there's a problem. All right, we got the problem. Management then gets in with compliance and talks about it. And listen, we're gonna talk about who is the right person, because I know there are compliance people who could not function in this role, right? I mean, and I know there's management people saying, well, you don't know my compliance officer. I get that, okay, and I acknowledge that. But it's about having the right person to make it the right role as you go and proceed. So for instance, you know, if you bring management and compliance right up front, and they come together and say, well, here's the problem, let's figure out a solution. And then you bring sales in, you kind of work it through, and everyone's on the same page. There's just, not only do you not have a scenario where compliance is now pitted against, where you're gonna have to do all this work, right, and then get the big X at the end and you can't do it. So all that wasted time. But there's also an aspect of coming up with the right solution first that has a longer term effect, and I'll give you an example now. So one of my clients had talked to compliance, and this is, by the way, there's a problem of over-compliance too, so I'll wait for that, and that's why it's important to bring both in. But essentially, they had gone to this compliance department in this one particular organization. Compliance was, frankly, pitted against sales. The whole dysfunction I talked about had gotten to kind of effort proportions. So this issue came up, and they said, well, we want to do, we have to have exceptions to meet pricing, right? When we have a competitor who comes with a lower price. And compliance came out and said, okay, well, our requirement is that you're gonna have to get an LE from whoever it is you're competing against. Now, that's obviously, in my opinion, overkill, right? I don't think that's the functioning of compliance, that's not functioning well, not the right type of mentality. Because you understand that's not viable, right? I mean, you're going to your consumer and saying, okay, so for you to get the rate that you want with the other company, you have to go to that company, get the rate, and then come back to me and then I'll match it. Anybody see a slight problem with that? Because why would I come back to you, right? Why wouldn't I just go with that? I mean, you're setting yourself up. You tell that to your sales force, and they're looking at you like you have three heads. And that's probably being conned, right? So that is not a viable solution. What happened is my client, not knowing that, put it in place, had uproar, okay? And then he talked to me after the fact, and I said, no, you don't need to do that. There's a different way to do this. It's not going to cause a problem. We came up with a solution. He was happy. He thought when he walked into a sales team, this has been in place for about 3 months, they were going to, he was going to be carried out as the hero. They really almost threw things at him. Because, so for the last 90 days, do you have deals I've lost, that's when he got back from a room full of people. And he walked in and was like, well, that was pretty much the worst meeting of my life. So, point being, I mean, this was an example where, if this had been handled at the upfront, the right way, with the right people, everyone talking at once, before a decision got put out, right, there would have been a better conclusion, and they may have come to the point in saying at the outset, hey, we need to get counsel involved in this. This isn't going to work this way. None of that happened. So that dysfunction led not only to a problem, where they frankly did lose money. Okay, but here's the other issue my client now has. Now I came in and I said, okay, but that wasn't a problem, but this is a problem, right? You can't keep doing this. This is an issue here. And he's like, well, I get it, I understand you're right, but I can't go back to that room of people and tell them this story. You know? So the point is, now he's really created this scenario where he's got people who either don't listen to him, or when he is gonna come up down here, it's like, so how many months is it gonna be before you tell us we don't have to do this now, right? The changes compliance loses legitimacy, as does management. That's the point, right? So by doing these things, you can set up scenarios where management loses credibility, compliance loses credibility, and frankly, what happens is the sales guys out in the field now say, forget it, I'm just not going to them, so they change their mind anyhow, and they just go broke, right? So the whole process starts to sort of come undone, and that's why it's really critical to do it this way. From this perspective, you know, the other thing that's really important is when management is able to get together with it, and they are able to go out to the field, and management and compliance have really kicked out a solution. When they go to the field, now it's, hey, we're in unison on this, we've thought the whole thing through, this is our resolution, right? So nobody's now set up in the corner as the bad guy. And what it means is that the people in the field now have to realize, like, this is sort of the way it's gonna be, and you diminish that rogue attitude of, well, we're just gonna do what we're gonna do because who cares about them anyhow, and management doesn't care about them anyhow, and they're just here to, like, you know, be negative Nancy, right? That mentality seems to go away when it's announced as a management decision as opposed to a compliance decision. Does that make sense? And that's the other thing you want is avoid change. Change in every organization is bad, even when it's good change. Like, how many of you guys have ever actually tried to make a very good change, whether it's benefits, and even no matter how great it is, there's still people resistant to change, right? Change is bad, automatically. So the more changes, the more bad. If you have it right the first time, fewer changes, it makes sense. The other thing also is it avoids things being missed and dropped through the cracks. So cracks, like where I said, you know, if one person is making a decision, and that's not really their level of expertise, they're gonna miss stuff. So, and you know, the outcomes of that are fines and all those other, and more change and reputational and all those things we're trying to avoid. So really, and then it creates kind of a background of non-compliance, because remember, one thing when they come in to audit you is they look for track records. Audits these days aren't about what you did yesterday or the pretty forms you can hand me today. They look back over the periods of time to see what you've done in the past. And so when you have records of non-compliance, look, is it good if you fixed it on your own? It's a whole lot better than not fixing it on your own, right? But wouldn't you prefer to have gotten it right the first time? Of course. So for all this to work, and I said it a minute ago, I alluded to this, I know that there are people probably in this room looking and saying, this would never work with my compliance officer, and you might be right. Because one of the things, you know, that we do at SCP is we hire compliance officers. We hire compliance officers for ourselves as well as for other companies. And so I've learned a thing or two, mostly by mistakes, about who to hire and not hire. And I'm gonna make a categorical statement that I'm gonna apologize in advance for doing this. And someone's gonna probably yell at me afterwards. So again, sorry to stereotype. It doesn't mean it applies to everybody. But do you know the people that I thought were gonna be the best compliance officer for my company and we started hiring them? I went after people who were at agency, who were with like the CMPB, state examiners. I thought, you know what, pull from the other team. Best idea, right? Big mistake. The reason why was because when they went into a client, and a very important part of what we do at SCP is to look at it from a business perspective, right? Understand compliance. Listen, I always tell people, you know, I can guarantee you will never get in trouble making a loan. You know how? Don't make one. Right? Am I right? That will guarantee it. Now, obviously, that's insane. But my point is, somebody who doesn't appreciate the fact that there's a cost benefit to everything you do can really not function in the kind of role I'm talking about for a compliance officer, because they're never going to be the person to say, hey, maybe you can't do that, but maybe you can do this, right? That's what you need in that role. So I'm not saying don't hire an examiner. I'm sure they're out there. I'm sure there are good ones. I'm just telling you, sometimes it may not be so clear, because this is not just my observation. I've had multiple clients come to me and say, hey, we gotta make a change in our compliance officer. And I'm saying, what's the wrong thing? I can't do anything. I can't run the business, right? They're out of their mind crazy with this because they can't say, they can never get a yes, right? And it's even things that come to me and I'll tell them yes. Because the other thing you gotta remember is, it's not only just, you know, that, the other things you have a high level of expertise. You know, you can look at something, take for example something if you don't know it that well. We've all been in scenarios where we're learning things and we're not really sure, right? We think of something in your life, driving, whatever it was. At some point in time, you didn't know how to do it that well. And so you were extra careful, right? So think about it. If you're being asked a question about RESPA or TILA or whatever it might be, and you don't really know the answer, you're going to go to a more conservative answer. That's very natural. And what happens, though, is that you as the business owners, guess what? You lose. Because all those opportunities that were between completely, totally safe and maybe a teeny bit of risk, but probably you're fine, you lost. Sometimes it's not even a teeny bit of risk, it's just misunderstandings. MSAs, excuse me, are a perfect example, right? People said, how many people said, oh, you can't do marketing services agreements? There's people still saying. I'm telling you, I have gotten letters of clearance for clients doing MSAs from the CFPB that say, you're okay. So I know 100% certainty you can do them because we have and we've been cleared, right? Can you do it? Yes, it's how you do it. You do certain things, it's not gonna work. You do others, it works. But the point is, if you're not aware of those specifics and you just hear MSAs because you read something on the internet, then you're gonna tell you can't do them. Okay, well, all those business opportunities that may have been okay just went out the door. So I think when you're looking for a compliance officer, you really have to take into account, it's not just about finding the biggest bodyguard at the door to keep everybody in check. Sometimes it's about finding somebody who meets the culture of the company. And that's what's critical, because without finding that type of person, you can't do what I'm saying here, right? Because you're never going to bring them into that initial role, if that makes any sense. And now as we're sort of progressing and we're seeing what's going on with the agency, there's things that are changing. Some of the craziness that really started this, right, when the CFP was super aggressive. I mean, look, I don't know who's going to have it, who isn't going to have it, clearly, because I blew it 2 days ago. But one thing I can tell you is, at least over the short term, we're going to see, and I'm short term in the next couple of years, right? I think we're going to see the ratchet down. Are we getting rid of LO comp? Probably not. Are we getting rid of a lot of rules? Probably not. Maybe some regulations will change here and there, they probably will. But the CFPB, isn't going away. Let's talk about sort of the risks of both approaches, though, right? There's the other approach that I've talked about, the more conservative approach. How about the less conservative approach? Companies that don't have any compliance or really sort of stick compliance in the back corner and say, nobody really has to go there, but we need a chief compliance officer, we stuck them in the back room, and we just leave them there, we shut the door, right? Because those companies are out there. And obviously, we talked about a lot of those. The one thing, though, is I do want to talk to you about is some of these are obvious fines and penalties and all that stuff. The reputational harm, I'll tell you, for clients that I've dealt with who have a situation that they've had to go through, the worst part of all that, and I mean with lots of money involved, okay? I have a client who was writing a 7 to 8 figure check, okay? So a lot of money there, right? That was the least of their concerns. Their problem was the potential reputational harm, right? We were able to, fortunately, keep it confidential. But that was, they would have paid double to keep it confidential, right? Because what would have happened, and I've seen it also, there's another client I had, they had a fair lending problem a couple years ago. And I didn't represent them in that, I represented them right afterwards. And what happened was they had to give out, as part of their settlement with DOJ, they had to give out a notice to every single new applicant that they had been found responsible for discriminating and consented to, this notice being sent to every borrower to fill that application. How many loan officers stayed with that company? How long? In 90 days, they were gone. Okay, and this was not a really small company. Okay, they weren't massive, but they were big enough. And in 90 days, gone. Why? Because they're loan officers. What would you do if you're a loan officer? I'm staying for this. I'm out of here, right? So that's what happened. That was the reputation harm. We killed them, not the fine. The fine's not the problem. It was a problem when they couldn't afford it anymore because they've had a lot of resources, that was fine. But again, we're talking about this too, the risks of being too conservative. You don't want to, and again, it's not just the short-term things about losing the business opportunities, it's losing the confidence of everybody around the company, right? Because when that happens, you end up in these types of situations. We've talked a little bit about the proper role. Now, what do we think is happening kind of moving forward and stuff? Some people have asked me, do I expect, especially now, I think this is a good discussion, one of the things thrown out there has been the idea of legislation. Anybody familiar with Financial Choice Act 2.0? We'll talk about that in a minute, but one of the things they've talked about that was not in there, okay, didn't even get past the Republican side, was some type of rate or exclusion from regulations for small lenders. Okay, that wasn't even on the Republican agenda. So it didn't even get past Hensarling, which tells you something, right? Because Hensarling thinks, you know, he's pretty opposite of order. So where's this going? Is there a possibility, and I know it's been brought up, that with the new head of CFPB, maybe that could be done from a regulatory perspective? Well, here's the one thing I would say with that. If the Republican establishment wouldn't even put it in their own proposed legislation, why would it go through in a regulation? Like, nobody supported it. Here's the other thing that you have to remember, is be careful what you wish for. And I had this conversation with somebody who works for an association trying to push something like this through, and I was, you know, they said, well, what do you think about it? And I said, I think it's kind of a bad idea, and here's why. Think about it. The sale of loans is what drives this whole market, right? If you can't sell it to investors, you can't make loans. Well, if I was an investor, and I could choose to buy loans from one group that had all these protections to make sure the loans were done well, or buy it from another group that didn't, who would you buy from? Right? Pretty easy. You'd certainly pay more for one than the other. And if you think about it, again, I mean, look what kind of happened in a way to some brokers. I mean, brokers used to really fuel this market, you know, to industry. 10 years ago, there were probably as many huge brokers as there were huge mortgage companies. But because of the way the rules got set and the way the responsibilities got shared, that started to push people on. And now those huge broker companies, they don't exist anymore. They used to. So I think that you have to be really careful in setting these things up, because you can see the same thing happening to community banks, in my opinion, if they were given too many regulatory relaxations against the other guys. Because if the other guys have a better product that's from a purchase of loan standpoint, they're going to have a huge advantage. You can also see the marketing potential aspect of it, where they can say, hey, we have to abide by all these things. If you go to XYZ, you can see how that gets set up. So, you know, be careful and think about that, because the first reactions to that type of regulatory agenda might be really positive, but those downward effects and downstream impacts can have really serious repercussions. The other thing, and again, I'm going to tell you, I'm going to say it right now, I am totally jaded when it comes to politics. I am. So, you know, the thing is that the people who are in the room who make these laws are usually not us, right? I mean, they're not. And if you need to look any farther than that, and it's one thing I wanted to talk about, is the Financial Choice Act 2.0. You know, it was billed, right, as the, wasn't it called Relief for Main Street or Mainstream Relief? Wasn't that they talked about it? Okay, so this is look, there were some great things. The CFPB doesn't exist anymore. By the way, it's replaced with something called the CLEA. It does the same thing. Okay, but right, I mean, this is the stuff we're talking about, right? We got rid of the CFPB. We created a different agency. But it certainly didn't have as many powers. Another thing, people said, well, the CLEA wouldn't have supervisory power anymore, right? Okay, now for your community, the Relief to Main Street, that's what we're talking about. Do you know how many Main Street banks get audited by the CFPB per year? Last year it was under 2%. 98% of the CFPB supervisory power spent on big banks. So, okay, jump up for joy. But two, you know, you see what I'm saying? It's a little bit overblown here. There's not a lot of relief to Main Street there. Then there is some. I'm not going to totally criticize it. There's some really good things about getting advisory opinions. Director being subject to termination or RIL, limiting the enforceability of the UDAP, and simplified expedited appeals to if they're doing something you don't like. So again, there are some really good things there, okay? But, you know, be really careful, okay? There is one little piece of that legislation that goes to my point about, as you're looking at these things, because a lot of changes are coming in the next, I don't know, 6-8 months, especially if you have a new director. Well, that's going to be very interesting to flush this out. But one of the things you have to see is that in the Act, okay, there was a provision that said that if a depository institution holds a loan in portfolio that they make, it's considered QM, even if it would otherwise be non-QM. Makes a little bit of sense. Because if you think about it, if I'm making the loan and I'm holding the loan and I'm taking the risk that the loan goes bad, then what's the problem? But here's the thing, think about this now from the perspective of being community banks, many of you. If that were to happen, and I'm Bank of America, let's just say, I've got enough money to make a huge portfolio, right? I can do a lot of loans that don't fit into QM. Here's the thing, if I turn them over every 3 years, By the time you have a loan for 3 years, it doesn't matter whether it's QM or non-QM, right? Because think about it, the whole point is ability to repay, good faith belief. If someone's paid payments for 3 years, you obviously had a good faith belief they could afford the loan, right? Because they made payments. It's sort of like, you know, we say in the law that it's res ipsa loquitur, the thing speaks for itself. If you made payments for 3 full years on time, well, clearly you had the ability to pay that loan with what I originated it, right? Because you did it. Sort of towards the point. So now what Bank of America, I'm only using them for an example, could do, or any big bank, flip that every 3 years, right? Or even 2 years, whatever number they come up with, and effectively be able to make non-QM loans as QM loans themselves. But companies that don't have the type of depository or that type of size to buy or hold their own loans couldn't make them. So you could very easily foresee a situation where community lenders simply could not compete. You would not be able to have the same products as large institutions, period, end of story, because yours would be non-QM and theirs would be QM, right? And that was clearly written in the rule, and it wasn't an accident because I talked to people when I read it, and I was like, huh, this kind of could be a problem, and yeah, we know, okay? So there was acknowledgement, that was very intentional, and it was literally two sentences in the whole act. So it's really important as you see these things coming through when people are dubbed it as one thing. That was fantastic for large institutional banks, right? It was there. It would have been a huge windfall. So just again, think about who making these rules, and every time there's a benefit to you, there's generally not going to not be a benefit to somebody else unless there's something really strong in the show. The other thing to remember, you know, I talked about this. Some of the things really going on now that I see a big push on is from FHA, from HUD. They're really pushing on quality control. They're really pushing these audits now. I've had, at least just in the last couple weeks, I've had 3 or 4 clients go from the mortgage review board. So they're pushing this very hard. One thing I think of a big look at is how you guys are setting up your, and this is where, again, the clients come into it, how you're setting up your QC process. Where are you putting checks in place? Where are you putting hard stops? These are all really critical elements that they're looking at right now because you know, one of the things they get into and have seen is they're doing these random audits and they're back office audits. You don't even necessarily know they're doing it of loans that have gone bad and they're checking into things. And it's not even about having bad neighborhood watch numbers, having high default rates. The clients that I've dealing with right now from the mortgage review board don't have any of those problems. But for whatever reason, they've selected them and they're really hitting them hard in their processes in terms of following all the processes and ensuring that they're being followed to a T. So this is really taking a higher front seat than it had in the past. The other thing also to remember about some of these legislations that you know, and regulations, you know, are they going to be rolled back? Things like LOCOM, things like TRID. I mean, come on. How many people in this room, I'm just curious, out of science, would actually like to run through TRID? Right? Wouldn't that be awesome? Probably actually pretty good for me, but you guys. Right? I mean, it's like, it's too late. It's too late. You can't undo this stuff. So, you know, what you really have to look for, I think, at this point is just creating that environment that's not as anti-business. That's really good. But rolling back the regulations, I don't think a lot of people want to do it. Large or small, it would cost too much money. It would create too much havoc. We're here. Let's just deal with it and move forward. But I think that's a large area. Don't also realize that the more that they pull off on the government, you know, the more plaintiff's lawyers get active. And that's something we've seen a lot of, too. A lot of RESPA lawsuits being filed. So some of the other things, do we see a rollback potentially, or do I see a rollback because, again, it's the investors pushing the market. They're not going to see this. And politically, there's no appetite for it. And for those institutions holding these loans, you know, and agencies, they're not going to let that happen. Privacy laws. What other changes are we going to have for this? So, you know, I think that, if anything, this is an area where I would love more government involvement. And people might look at me like a little crazy here when I say that. Here's why. If you've ever had a data breach in multiple jurisdictions, you know exactly why I'm saying this. Because right now, there's a different law in each jurisdiction. And for each place you are, you have a different thing that you have. Just to figure out what I need to do, you have to first figure out where was the data breach, okay, which laws apply. It's a nightmare. Wouldn't it be better if there was one set of laws, right? I knew there's a data breach, and now I have to do this, as opposed to interpreting 36 different states and figuring out what I need to say each one, but ultimately just taking the state that's quote unquote worse and doing that for everyone because I'm not dealing with 36 different letters, right? That's the scenario. So if anything, that would be a great place for there to be more federal regulations. It's pretty neat as it's patchwork right now. You know, LOCOM, this is really an area where I think there, it's not being rolled back and it shouldn't be probably at this point, but there are some changes that could come up. I was recently at an event where Portia was speaking, and there were some lenders there, actually some of the clients there, one of the clients invited me. And so I was sitting there with it, and they asked him a question about bond loans, and you know, complaining about why you have to pay the same on bond loans as other loans, it's unprofitable. And Portia actually turned around and said, well, I don't know why you'd have to do that, you could pay different lenders. I mean, I understand the point there. The first my client and a couple other ones, they like, you know, I was tomorrow's turkey, because they were not happy because I was telling them they can't do it. The other student was like, oh man, this is so bad. You know, I was not happy. And then all of a sudden, some guy comes over to Portia and goes, really? I'm gonna have to get back to you guys on that answer I just told you a second ago, because apparently there's some confusion on this point, and I see your point, but I don't think the rules are read that way, and that's something we need to look at. So, so the point being, there are certain areas that I don't know how they didn't get up that high X years in, right? Whatever, right? That's a problem with DC sometimes. But the point being that there are these particular areas, and I think rather than focusing on getting rid of the rule altogether, it's probably a better mindset and to go in and say, hey, here's examples of, you know, these situations where we're going to lose money because of bond loans, or it's a 203k construction loan, and there's no realistic way where we could steer the borrower. You know, there's all these types of different areas where there's some common sense changes that could be made, and my hope is that with a new regulation, and a new directive, there'll be the opportunities to, in fact, make those changes. I think that's a better use of time, though, than just wholesale rollback of the regulations, because here's the other thing. It's just going to be a pendulum. If there's a full rollback, what happens next time when I'm sort of making a joke here, Elizabeth Warren becomes president? I have a feeling it would go the other way. And by the way, if any of you says that can't happen, right? ability to repay. This is probably an area where there is going to be a lot of change. Now remember, this when this was put into place, this started in, what, 13, I think, 14? 14? There was a certain window, there's a 7-year temporary rule where a lot of the loans currently being made today are subject to the 7-year temporary QM window, which expires in 21, which isn't, it's really not that far away, right? If there's a solution, they gotta work on it ahead of time. There's no guarantee they're gonna do that. So there's already people looking at this and trying to figure out what's gonna be sort of the next fix to it. Is there going to be some opening up? I mean, the whole idea here was to create private capital into the non-QM market. For many of you, as you know, that really hasn't happened too much. There's not much of a non-QM market. So with that not having developed, their idea didn't really work. And when the 7-year hold breaks, a lot of loans, I think people said almost 25% of current loans, will not be able to be made under the current rules. So something's got to happen here. There's a time ticking here. So something's got to happen with this. I don't really see also ATRs there. There's going to be a lot of government enforcement. I've heard about it, I haven't seen it, and I'm not sure what they would do about it. It's mostly private enforcement and affecting the market, and again, changes making they've tried to get really happen from that perspective. TRID, I think obviously there's some agenda and some rules in place this is probably one of the unfortunate things of the freeze of regulations, because there were some changes coming up to fix the black hole, things like that that really haven't come to fruition because they've been stalled. Again, that's something that would be great if a change on the CFPB. I would think that would be able to go through and certainly kind of support a lot of people. UDEM, now this is probably the best part of having a new director, because you know the thing with Corduroy and the CFPB as currently created was that everything was UDEM, right? I mean, if I couldn't figure out something else, it was UDEM. And that's how the rules kind of written, right? It gives them a massive amount of authority. But the right person in charge of the CFPB, even somebody I think who would be center line and would potentially get past Congress, I don't think you'd see anywhere near the level of aggressiveness that's been done to this point. You know, but understand that's going to be a big target, a big part of what goes on here. The other thing is it's also an area of legislation. In the Financial Choice Act, they wanted to really give it more definition, because right now, I mean, UDOP's sort of like the Supreme Court's definition of pornography. I know when I see it. That's pretty much what it is now. It needs to be controlled a little bit more, and that's one of the areas where I think new leadership may be important. Remember also with advertising and marketing, a lot of these CFPB cases haven't actually been started by the CFPB. Okay, that's really important, because I know they take the lead, but you know the FCC and FTC have been involved in it, as have states. And I will tell you, in the last, like, 3 to 4 months, states have gotten very, very active in this area. So again, they've seen the CFPB sort of pulling back a little bit, they've stepped in. So in terms of your focus on sales and marketing and in terms of compliance around it, don't get too relaxed on that stuff. There's still a lot of opportunity and risk there. Again, do I think some of the arbitrariness, some of the overreaching, some of these cases that you've seen go on in the last year where they just kind of really went overboard, I think some of that's there, but this isn't time to say, oh, send out your advertising, don't worry about it anymore. There's still a lot of people looking at it. But I do think you're going to see fewer federal enforcement actions moving forward on this. And you know, I mentioned MSAs, you know, what could you and what can't you do? I think the key things on MSAs, and I don't want to keep you guys too long or extend my time, but some of the things you have to do in MSAs and what keeps them lawful is to focus on the consumers, okay? Your marketing should actually really be focused and driven towards them, not towards creating more relationships with the realtors, towards branding, that type of thing. So instead of having your Friday lecture to realtors, right, which a lot of people do, a meeting and tell the realtors about the new products, have to be a first-time borrower symposium, bring your clients there, right? And the realtors can come with it, that type of thing. There's all type of things like that, having forward-facing. Make sure they're not exclusive. Make sure that there's full disclosure to the borrowers if there is a referral or the existence of that relationship. And I'd say disclose, disclose, and disclose again. Verification of the value of what you're doing, and then only pay for what you receive, right? Only pay if you're actually doing or receiving the benefits of that agreement. Don't just pay to have the agreement. You can still do networks and sponsorships, right, outside of MSAs. Again, key is valuation and having some legitimacy. But I will tell you in this area, it's sort of a sliding scope or sliding scale. You know, if you, someone said to me, well, can I do like an annual party with the realtors? Yes, but if that annual party becomes a weekly party, that's much more problematic, right? This is all sort of a slippery slope, sliding scale. Be reasonable and try to actually build into these things something you get out of it. So if there's an annual thing you're sponsoring, get something out of it. Get a 5-minute speech, right? Get some type of branding, something that's, that you can justify why you're doing it, other than paying for it. And then with co-marketing, I'm somebody who's not, I'm not afraid of doing work with Zillow. I don't think you should be either. Again, it's reasonable. Set up in such a way, don't do the 90% deals, right? Where you used to be able to pay for 90% with a realtor, it doesn't make sense. 50-50. Okay, that's sort of the idea. You can use common sense towards it. The other thing is also to make sure you have a lot of controls in place, because this is where when you don't have controls, things can get problematic for you. So for example, if you have, I had one place where I had three loan officers paying 50% of one realtor's, of the same realtor's leads. But, and I literally, the person said to me, yeah, but we're only paying 50%. Like, I'm not that bad. act. And I'm not good, by the way, so that's why I went to law school. So those are the types of things that it's a lot of common sense to have controls in place around you. And these are the other things when you're looking at it, just kind of your general concerns here. This is another big one with your lead generators. Again, I will tell you, I've even seen my own alleged, you know, approval of lead gen companies who say, yeah, well, you know, we spoke to Ari and he said, you know, we're off of Kerman, they said, you can do it. And I called Danielle and she and I threw a lot of stuff together. They're like, did you talk to them? Because I don't remember talking to them. Yeah, I talked to them, but I never said they could do anything like this. Did you? No. And yet, here's something that says we gave them a letter, which we never gave them. Look, check them out, okay? Some are more legit than others. But the one thing you gotta remember, you're responsible for your lead gen companies that you hire. So if they do something wrong or anything wrong, it is absolutely 100% your responsibility. So don't just take it for granted if they say, oh, you know, we verify that what we do is compliant. It's also how you use it. So they might be using it one way that's different than you. You're gonna be responsible for that. On your vendor management, third party responsibility, you really gotta be sure of that. And then, you know, look, for any of you that don't have a 100-minute implementation plan, you know, change or no change, I don't see anything stopping between now and 2018 that's gonna slow this thing down. This train sort of left the station. So really make sure you've got your 100-minute implementation plan in place. The other thing that's super important now, because remember this, and it's sort of like my parting words here because I'm out of time, but just remember that when they have this data, they're gonna be able to see everything about your company, okay? So if you have problems in pricing or compensation that are causing some abnormalities and how certain groups get priced or not, even if it doesn't cause those, they're gonna be able to see it. So if you have issues, it's a really good idea to find out now and fix them before you start reporting this, because these are automatic uploads to the government, and they're gonna see everything. So it's the kind of thing where, like, yeah, if you've got an issue, you would have fixed it now before it becomes very apparent next year. So it's the biggest thing I would say as a takeaway. Changes or not changes, this stuff is going forward, as far as I know, right? And I just don't see how timing's gonna stop it. So especially on the HMDA stuff, you wanna do a regression analysis, you wanna make sure you have somebody review your pricing policies and your comp policies, both on an LO and branch basis, because that stuff is gonna find its way into showing itself. And those regressions that go to the government once you start uploading this data. So I'm sort of out of time here, but I want to say, you guys have any questions before I shut off here? Yes.
This is kind of a loan originator comp / fair lending question, and it's kind of actually goes back to sort of your lead generation letter example, where your name gets tossed around a lot. So. From your perspective on originator comp, pick-a-pay plans, you know, if you end up with a pick-a-pay plan where you have, say, 10 LOs in an office, in a single office, and there's four different rate sheets going around all on the same product, can you give your perspective on that? Is there a way to do that and not be out of compliance?
Yeah, I mean, I think there is. Look, I think the problem with pick-a-pay plans is they've been abused. Right? I mean, if you understand the way fair lending mathematically works in the assessment and the underlying laws, if I have mortgage loan originator A in the same branch as B, and A gives 101.25 all day long, you could be black, white, red, green, or blue, right? And loan originator B gives 101.5, no matter what, right? And I come in and I happen to be blue, and I get 101.5. Was it on account of my race? Of course it wasn't, right? It's because he gets 101.5. That's the price for everybody. Legally, that's not a problem. Where the problem comes in, though, okay, is if you happen to put 101.5 person into the community in Camden, New Jersey, that happens to be highly minority, and the other person gets to go to, you know, whatever other community is not minority USA, and you sort of dictated out how it's gonna flow, right? That's where the pay starts to go wrong. But there's some other things that people do wrong with pick-a-pay. They have huge deviations, right? Where it's 101 and 103. You're gonna have a problem, right? Or it's 101.257, 101.259, and you've got 57 buckets for 57 people.
and they're able to move a month. Like, come on, why does that happen, right? So it has to be created in such a way that it creates a disincentive to move or up price because, right, I can move buckets and it's got to create a disincentive. Like, where you are is where you are and that's where you stay, right? That's where you stay. And I think it's, if it's more geared in such a way that recognizes that different people do have different businesses. In other words, if I'm the guy who sells lotion, I may not call you back, I won't say thank you, and I certainly don't send you a bottle of wine when you're done with your stupid clothes. If you're that guy, like, you'll get the best price, right? If I'm that guy, or compared to the guy who's like coming to your house, you know, picking you up, you know, shining your shoes and helping you sign the paper and, you know, dusting you off when you leave, right? That level, so right? And guess what? I'm not the cheapest, but you're gonna love me. If you're that person, that legitimately justifies and can justify differentiation and compensation. The key being, okay, and what I'm saying, and we're doing that as an analogy because I know no one falls exactly in those spaces. But my point being that I think you can have different markets for different people in your organization. And the key is that if you set up your comp in such a way, right, that it doesn't create a disincentive or an incentive for people to try to skip and upsell or to target a certain community. And you're cognizant of the community you're allowing us to serve, and there's enough of them such that the averages work out, then I think you're okay. And again, you put a higher and lower bracket on it, so you don't have somebody in the extreme here or an extreme there on either side, right? If you have those controls around it, I think you can have variation of the comp, whether it's within your company or within a branch. And I'll even go further to say that if I had branch pricing only, in other words, if everyone at one branch is one way and everyone at another branch is another way, I think you have a higher level for a fair living problem there. Because what happens is if this branch happens to be located in a more minority-driven, heterogeneous area than homogeneous area, whatever you would call it, right? So if I put somebody in, you know, Oakland, right? I have a branch in Oakland, and then I have a branch in Orange County, right? If those branches are where they are and the pricing in Orange County is lower, every loan in Orange County is going to be lower, automatically. So I can tell you exactly how your fair lending is going to work out now, right? I know with 100% certainty. I don't even need to do a regression. But if I have different loan officers in different places and they're still scattered, the variances amongst them are going to make that regression on average work out better. Because it's sort of like throwing 1,000 marbles up in the air, right? If you throw them up and they scatter wherever they scatter, the randomness of life should cause them to flow out in such a way that you're going to have half the blue and half the white here, right? If you only have two, those variances can't exist as much, so mathematically, chance for a finding of discrimination is increased. Does that make sense?
No.
Okay.
No, because, well, you're talking about two different LOs have two different business models. It's the same company, same office. Two people walk in off the street, pick wrong. You've now penalized one just because they randomly picked wrong.
But remember, what is discrimination? Ask if you've acted differently on account of your race, not have you acted differently. It's that second phrase that's critical, right? So if I walk in, let's just take a silly scenario. I walk in and they say, I hate people who wear suits. We're giving discounts to people who wear jeans. Is that awful? Absolutely. It may not be the best business, but it's totally awful. Because wearing jeans versus wearing suits is not a discriminatory issue, right? Like, that's not a protected group. So the point is, you're asking, is it discrimination? It's simply not. If you can prove exactly why I give 101.5, and that's what I give to everybody, you give 101, and I read the little blade. Where it really comes out as a problem, though, is if especially take my branch scenario, a branch at lower pricing, is it a more diverse area than one another, right? That pricing that's higher in that area is going to result in minorities getting higher pricing. Now you have no problem, right? But if you had 20 loan officers in that branch and they're going all over the place, sending people all over the place, and you've got 20 over here going and doing all their stuff, when you mathematically put all those loans in and all those variances, I don't know how it's going to flow out. Right? I have no idea how that's going to come out. There's no way, but I know in one scenario, don't go. And as long as it doesn't flow out in such a way that it's actually caused a disparate impact, then you don't have a disparate impact. I know you're putting your fingers on
the table.
I would say I have a lot of clients that have done that, and they don't do proper aggressions. It's critical, yes. Do you have to do your aggression testing? 1,000,000%, especially if you're a pet. But to be honest, you're insane if you're not doing aggression testing now. I don't care what your pet is, right? It has to be done. So that's, I mean, I wouldn't let that risk dissuade you from doing it, but set it up right. Like, that's pretty key. If you set it up wrong, then you can get in trouble. Does that make sense? Any other questions? All right. Well, listen, if you guys, I'm not going to be able to stick around, but Shelly is here, and she's with us. She's with Clients Partners. So if you have questions or want to reach out to her, she's going to be here the rest of the day. I've got to jump on, like, I don't know, like 10 to 5 or something this week. So, anyhow, thank you very much for having me.
Thanks, Shelly. Thank you, Ari. Again, we appreciate you coming here. Before we have our next speaker, and Mark Evans, if you'll come up from National MI to introduce him, I did want to share something, and Ari, you may be aware of this, but the CFPB actually has been reaching out across the country to get feedback on ATR from members of the industry.
Yes.
And in fact, Dave Getty and Brian Traylor were both in Denver at the MBA convention, and we had, and Lynn Tamanini, thank you for reminding me, Lynn. We had an opportunity with a representative from the CFPB along with one of their attorneys, and we had a full hour with them, and I think that went very well. So we also are going to follow up with our membership, because they did want even more feedback, because they have a concern, as Ari mentioned, that if that patch goes away and there's nothing to replace it,